This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's been a long time since I've been this excited about a new natural medical innovation. Zona Plus is the real deal. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 1-888-408-6141. That's 1-888-408-6141 or tryzona.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, talking today to neurologist Dr. Sidney Kern. His book is Herbs and Nutrients for Neurologic Disorders. And we're going to talk treatment strategies for Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, stroke, MS, migraine, and seizures, which, according to Dr. Kern, may have similar origins. Yeah, there are variations on the theme, but the thought is that there are various insults to the body that aren't handled properly, and depending on your genetics, you may manifest one or another of these neurodegenerative conditions. So, Dr. Kern, let's tackle Parkinson's first. What are some of the main strategies for working with Parkinson's patients?
Well, one of the things, it's well established that the mitochondria, or the little organelles that make energy in the cells, particularly in the brain stem, an area called the substantia nigra. So there is what's called an electron transport chain in the mitochondria, and it has five complexes. The first one we know is weak, and it contains a molecule called CoQ10, which a lot of the listeners may be familiar with. I should add that the statins that we take to lower cholesterol interrupt the manufacturing in the body of CoQ10. So anyone taking a statin should really be taking CoQ10.
And clinically, I think there are some studies that show that statin users are more prone to Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, and it could be related to the decrement or the lowering of CoQ10 in the body. There may be other mechanisms, I'm sure, as well. So we would supplements that we use is CoQ10. We used to use ubiquinone, which is the oxidized form of CoQ10, but now available is ubiquinol. Mm-hmm. And the dosage of ubiquinol is half what the dosage of ubiquinone is.
I must point out, though, that in some of the studies that I've looked at recently, CoQ10, while seemingly plausible for Parkinson's, hasn't come up big in terms of outcomes. Presumably you're on top of that data, and are there any studies that really support the use of it?
Yeah, there was a study at UC San Diego, and this is now maybe 10 years ago, but they used 1,200 milligrams of ubiquinone, which is a pretty high dose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the outcome measures were definitely better in the patients that took 1,200 milligrams ubiquinone compared to controls. And I haven't seen any recent clinical trials, but
so it may be that if you translate that to ubiquinol, you'd need at least 600, perhaps 800 of ubiquinol, which can be a little pricey, but hey, it's a serious condition. And you may want to go hard with the ubiquinol.
Everything you just said is correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is expensive, and I don't think that the individual with Parkinson's has to take that much.
Mm-hmm.
But that was what the UC San Diego study used.
Okay. Also, in Parkinson's, you talk about an herb called macuna. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. Macuna pruriens has a high concentration of L-DOPA. The big breakthrough, and Oliver Sacks wrote a book about it called Awakenings, is when they first discovered L-DOPA, these patients would arouse out of this frozen state. that they had been in for a long time. But the problem was it was very unstable. Their clinical status was very unstable. So Sinemet, which people may be familiar with, actually contains what's called carbidopa, which helps prevent the breakdown of the L-DOPA and smooths the clinical response. So mecunopurians has a high concentration of L-DOPA in it, I've used it in a number of Parkinson's disease patients. The problem is the carbidopa prevents it from getting, I'm sorry, I misspoke before. The carbidopa prevents it from getting broken down in the blood. So if you just take mecunopurians or dopabine, you're not going to absorb a lot into the central nervous system. So what I would do is I would prescribe mecunopurians, and then I would prescribe about 25 milligrams of carbidopa with each time they took. And you can take, for example, 100 milligrams of L-DOPA. It's easy to calculate how much of the mecunopurians you need. And I had one patient in particular who I followed for 5 to 10 years, and he never did take Sinemet. He just took mecunopurians and carbidopa and did quite well. And there's no question. I mean, it's been measured, and but this is not standard practice in conventional medicine for a variety of reasons, which you've probably discussed at some point on your show.
Well, it's basically a bias against nutraceuticals, I think, and the preference for using prescription drugs. Have you any experience with nicotinamide riboside? Because that seems to be a promising nutrient for supporting NADH, which appears to be a real important issue in Parkinson's, the mitochondrial output, energy production, and so on.
Yeah, actually, I've been taking it myself. There's been a lot of publicity on this anti-aging pill, and what it contains is nicotinamide riboside and pterostilbene.
I think it's called Basis is the product, and it's you know, every time you open up Facebook or an ad, a pop-up ad appears, and they're pitching it to you.
They have a lot of promotion, and they have some very well-known people behind it. But you can buy the individual products. They're cheap. You can get them on Amazon. And, one of the things they do is I think they help the what's called the proteasome. When your genes make proteins, you have to break them down. Otherwise, your cells would get clogged up. And there's two ways to break them down. One is called the proteasome, and the other is the lysosome. And so it's my understanding nicotinamide riboside helps the proteasome. It also helps what are called sirtuins, which are molecules that turn off genes. As we get older, our genes become disinhibited. I mean, we only about 5 to 10% of our genes are active at any point in time, and it's a little bit like playing the piano. Our genes are turned off and on frequently during the day, depending upon what you eat, what your activity is, and it's a very refined system. But as we get older, we lose the ability to inhibit genes. And we get protein products, and they get there's deposition of these products into Lewy bodies in Parkinson's disease and into amyloid plaques in Alzheimer's disease. And so I think the nicotinamide riboside and the pterostilbene are important also in promoting these molecules called sirtuins, which silence genes.
So. Also, in Parkinson's, and I think in MS, they're now using an amino acid, inosine or inosine, as a way of, I think the strategy has to do with increasing levels of uric acid as a protective substance. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. Uric acid can be broken down in two ways. One of them actually makes a free radical, and another way does not. Uric acid is a very important antioxidant in the body. And
we tend to look at uric acid as a bad thing because it causes gout. But when it's too high, you can get crystalline deposits in your joints that are very painful. But too low uric acid can be a problem as well, especially in terms of the brain, right?
Right. I mean, it's an important antioxidant, and inosine actually increases the production of uric acid. And it's an important. It's not the nutrient of the decade, but it's an important. It's certainly an important nutrient.
So let's switch gears and talk a little bit about MS, because a pretty prevalent problem. I believe there may be a couple of million sufferers of MS, and I think I personally believe, and you have validated that belief in your chapter in the book about MS, that there are some very potent nutritional strategies that can be harnessed to treat MS. So what are some of those?
Yeah, well, in MS, you tend to lose myelin. The plaques, which form in the brain, are basically areas of loss of myelin, although recently it's been discovered that early on the nerve fiber itself, called the axon, degenerates as well. But in terms of the myelin, there are certain nutrients that promote the manufacturing of myelin. Biotin, the B12, the B vitamin, biotin helps promote the myelin.
In fact, in very high doses, the biotin that is used, and we now have compounding pharmacies making this biotin at very high doses, is perhaps 100 times stronger than what you can buy over the counter in a health food store. Doses like 100 or 300 milligrams a day.
Yeah, it's much higher than the RDA.
Because it's sold as micrograms, and the dosage that works for MS is in milligrams. So it's
right.
It's really mega dosing.
Yeah, in my book, I recommended 50 milligrams twice a day, but there may be even higher dosages that are recommended. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's important for, and it's played a role in the history of MS, is essential fatty acids. There's an interesting phenomena that people at the equator have a very low incidence of MS, but as you go to northern latitudes, you get a higher incidence. And there's been a history of trying to discover why, but it would appear that vitamin D, which is manufactured in the body with exposure to sunlight, vitamin D is now considered a hormone. It's not just for absorbing calcium from the gut. And as you get to higher and higher latitudes, you have less exposure to sunlight, you have less vitamin D. And essential fatty acids tend to have vitamin D in them. There was an interesting study in Norway that people on the coast of Norway had a very low incidence of MS, and people in landlocked areas had a higher incidence.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They tended to eat meat, and the people on the coast ate fish.
Yeah.
And fish is very high in essential fatty acids,
which may be anti-inflammatory and also may be a constituent of the phospholipids that make
myelin.
Up the cell membranes, the myelin. Yeah.
That's right.
Other plausible strategies for MS in terms of diet? Is there a particular diet that seems to be conducive?
In terms of mainstream neurology, dopamine, which is related to amino acid, if you're eating a meal that's high in protein, you're not going to absorb as much. And so there's a classic diet that recommends that you put most of your protein intake towards the evening, and you try to take your Sinemet or your L-Dopa.
This is for Parkinson's. This is in Parkinson's. Yeah.
This is for Parkinson's.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, in MS.
Yeah, with the Swank diet has been popularized, but now there's sort of pushback from the MS community. Terry Walls, who's real prominent in that community, is advocating more of a paleo diet, which I tend to favor because I think that there may be in autoimmune diseases a dietary component where certain modern foods, wheat, dairy, grains, beans, may have a damaging effect on the microbiome or may cause leaky gut syndrome and cause some kind of molecular mimicry that it ultimately attacks the brain. So I guess there's some controversy over, you know, vegetarian or vegan diet versus higher protein paleo diet for MS. Do you have a favorite?
I haven't gotten into diet with my patients so much with MS. I know that, first of all, you want to avoid trans fatty acids.
For sure.
Because they're oxidative, they're damaging. You also want to avoid, if you can, organic food is definitely more expensive, but if you can afford organic food.
You want to avoid neurotoxins in any case if you have a neurological disorder. You know, potential neurotoxins.
Right.
Yeah.
You want to eat more fish because meat has saturated fatty acids, and whereas the myelin, you really want polyunsaturated fatty acids, which you get in fish.
Mm-hmm. You also
I think Mediterranean diet seems to be
helpful.
The one that seems to survive the longest of all of these diets.
You also give you give props to PQQ, which is kind of a new nutrient on the horizon. You have actually a special afterword in your book, which you devote to promising new supplements, and PQQ, which I always have a heck of a time pronouncing. Let's see, pyroloquinolone quinone. How am I doing on that?
Right. Yeah, you did pretty well. Pyroloquinolone quinone. Well, the first thing that attracted me to PQQ is it actually is a carbon compound in interstellar space, in the space between stars.
Wow.
And I thought, well, that's interesting. There's actually a spaceship that has these cups that go out and they gather the interstellar dust, and they have a device on the spaceship to try to measure it. And they haven't pinpointed exactly, they know it's a quinone and they think it's a pyridoquinoline quinone. The interesting thing about PQQ is that it helps in the creation of more mitochondria. It's mitochondrial genesis.
Hmm.
And that's very important. It's also antioxidant. It's found in all life forms. And the reason I recommended it is it has so many functions that are beneficial. I think it's also anti-inflammatory. And promoting the formation of more mitochondria, particularly as you age, much more so maybe in Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease and just general health. I just think it's an excellent supplement to take.
So while we're touring the various neurological disorders, let's comment a little bit on migraines. You have a chapter on migraines. What are some of the nutritional factors that might be involved there?
Well, glutamate plays an important role in migraine. So it's important for migraine patients to have a lot of magnesium, which I think is in dark leafy green vegetables. I'm not an expert on diet, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But migraine's very important. Checking my chapter here, actually. Hold on just one second.
Well, I'll prompt you with some of the things that your book talks about. Riboflavin, which is it's known to some people as the B vitamin that makes your pee very yellow, right? If you take
right.
a lot of it.
Right.
That's something that for some reason seems to help in migraineurs.
Yeah, I think riboflavin is involved in some of the cycles inside the mitochondria. So there's definitely dysfunction of mitochondria in migraine. So it'd be worth taking CoQ10. I also want to mention that taurine, which is an amino acid without one of the side groups called a carboxyl group, taurine blocks glutamate. And actually, you can take magnesium taurate, so you get both compounds in one mm-hmm. In one pill. That's very important. Also, I would recommend that people take CoQ10 because we know that there's hypofunction or loss of function of mitochondria, particularly in the migraine attack.
Mm-hmm.
What
about some of the herbs that they recommend for migraines? I think feverfew has been cited, and then also butterbur.
Right. This is traditional medicine, and we know that it, generally if an herb survives over centuries of use, then it probably has some effect. Butterbur is really promoted a lot. There's a corporation that's involved in its manufacturer, whereas feverfew you can grow yourself. You can actually learn how to tincture these flowers, and I think they're beneficial. It depends upon the patient. There's some migraine patients that are really refractory. I haven't personally found butterbur and feverfew to be mm-hmm. significantly effective in mm-hmm. migraine.
So,
I mean, it depends upon the kind of migraine they have and so on.
So with Alzheimer's, I just want to touch on Alzheimer's briefly, and you know, there's a very detailed sure. chapter on Alzheimer's, but some of the same principles apply, dealing with inflammation, fixing the microbiome, optimizing mitochondrial function, essential fatty acids, antioxidants. These are some of the strategies that you talk about, but are there any specific nutrients that we haven't touched upon that you want to mention as plausible for supporting brain function in dementia or Alzheimer's?
Yeah, there is, actually. There's a compound called huperzine A, or Chinese club moss. It's been used in Chinese medicine for maybe 1,000 years. And huperzine A turns off the enzyme that breaks down acetylcholine. And in memory, acetylcholine is probably one of the most important neurotransmitters. And so, like Aricept, there's several pharmaceuticals that we use mm-hmm. in Alzheimer's disease. Huperzine A is actually more potent than they are.
It's a cholinesterase inhibitor, like the drugs, but it outperforms
right.
some of the prescription meds.
Correct. And I can actually personally vouch for huperzine A.
Wow.
Because if I stop it, I notice it. When I start it, my memory improves.
Hmm.
But as you said, the other thing that we haven't talked about is resveratrol,
sure.
Which comes from grapes. Resveratrol actually improves the function of an organelle I mentioned earlier on, which was the proteasome. And so what happens is in Alzheimer's disease, is there's amyloid molecules which they tend to cluster together and form what are called plaques. And the better the proteasome works, the more that it could break down the amyloid molecules. So resveratrol, in theory, you know, it's hard to do. There's no incentive for pharmaceutical companies to do double-blind studies on these products, but certainly there's plenty of evidence to support the use of resveratrol, and it's quite safe.
And finally, there's acetyl L-carnitine, or ALC.
Right. That actually does two things. One, it provides the acetyl groups to molecules that you need, and then the molecule acetyl-carnitine itself seems to be able to transport fatty acids across the mitochondrial membrane, and so it helps provide food for the mitochondria. And thereby the mitochondria will make more ATP, and so your cells will have more energy. And one of the reasons the mitochondria is sort of central to the demise of cells in a lot of these disorders, because if you can't make enough energy, the cell cannot protect itself, and there's a lot of deleterious things that can hurt your nerve cells, as well as the supportive cells called glia. And so acetylcarnitine is a good nutrient, and it helps make acetylcholine, you know, which is the neurotransmitter for memory, as we discussed.
And finally, there's ginkgo, a popular remedy for memory problems. What's the evidence for it, or is it just a popular phenomenon?
Well, no, there's a lot of studies on ginkgo. I think the last time I looked, there was like 50 or 60 studies. Ginkgo protects, we talked about the electron transport chain inside the mitochondria. There's also the Krebs cycle, but the electron transport chain is the primary chain for making primary molecular mechanism for making ATP, and ginkgo seems to protect there's five complexes in the electron transport chain, and ginkgo seems to protect the first complex. Ginkgo also seems to stabilize the blood-brain barrier. There's a lot of molecules you do not want to get into your brain. The brain would not like them. And so there's a barrier that knows which molecules can go in and which molecules can go out. And in some conditions, the blood-brain barrier becomes weakened or inflamed, or if there's a, you know, a tumor or a head injury, there's a mechanical injury to the blood-brain barrier. And ginkgo actually stabilizes the blood-brain barrier. So that's another function that it has.
Well, you provided us with lots of practical tips, but there's a lot more in a very comprehensive listing for Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, stroke, multiple sclerosis, migraine, and seizures. The book is Herbs and Nutrients for Neurological Disorders. Our guest, Dr. Sidney Kern, K-U-R-N. And I want to thank you very much for joining us today. The book is excellent.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on.
It's my pleasure. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.